From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is Which Way LA.
Plastic bags and Dodger baseball. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Dodger Stadium was sold out on this 50th anniversary of opening day in Chavez Ravine. Magic Johnson was not there, but the LAPD was out in force. We'll get a look back from a fan who saw the Dodgers beat the Yankees in Dodger Stadium in the World Series of 1963. Also tonight, the era of plastic bag bans from Santa Monica to L.A. to L.A. County to Sacramento. Is paper better or worse? Later on, is academic freedom a disguise for religion? First, here's the news. We're on back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Tennessee's Republican legislature has enacted a new law allowing teachers to question the science of evolution. Is it back to the Scopes trial of 1925? Why is challenging global warming also protected? We'll hear more about that later on. First, the Dodgers played the Pittsburgh Pirates on this 50th opening day in Chavez Ravine. The stadium was sold out, but the biggest single crowd may have been from the LAPD, which was there on bikes and undercover and scouting in uniform for drunken tailgaters in the parking lots. Nobody's forgotten last year's opening game when Giants fan Brian Stowe was beaten so badly he suffered brain damage. Two suspects have pleaded not guilty to that mayhem and assault and a battery. But let's talk about history of a very different kind. Tomas Benitez saw a very historic game in Dodger Stadium back in 1963. He is now development director at Plaza de la Raza and an advisor to Baseball Reliquary. That's a traveling sports museum. Tomas Benitez, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Tell us about that game back in 1963.
Well, golly, you know, the fun thing about it was that the Dodgers opened up in 62.
Right.
And my father at the time was starting out of practice in East L.A. He was an optometrist. And so his patent response to my request to go to the stadium was always, we'll do it, we'll do it. Finally, we make our first game at the Dodger Stadium, and it happens to be Game 4 of the 63 series with my hero, Sandy Koufax, on the mound.
Whoa.
Against the hated New York Yankees. And it was also the series in which the Dodgers, they had lost in a heartbreak playoff against the equally hated Giants the year before, but came back and won in 63, and they actually swept the Yankees in the 63 series on that game, and I got to see it.
Was Koufax the winner?
Oh, yeah. He was the winner, and he was at his best. And the Yankees were no slouches. I mean, it was the days of, you know, Madeline Maris and Ellie Howard and Bobby Richardson and Tom Tresh and all the rest of them, Whitey Ford on the mound. But the Dodgers just had magic. They had Maury Wills and Tommy Davis and Willie Davis and Roseboro and Koufax and Drysdale. And now we see a return to magic. How's that for a segue, Warren?
Oh, that's beautifully done. Beautifully done. You got to be in radio. But magic apparently wasn't at the game today. But there's a real change of atmosphere now as far as the Dodgers are concerned.
Well, you know, it's all attitudinal. I mean, you know, the deal is still cooking and, you know, the McCourt's still around. But the whole idea that they're on the way out, you know, that there's some, you know, that magic has returned and brought, you know, good spirit back to the ballpark, to the game, to the team. And, you know, the McCourt's, you know, have made their bed. And you know, there are fans that are you know, looking forward to them leaving. So it's been this negative kind of thing replaced with, you know, one of LA's greatest citizens of all time, Magic Johnson, and a return to the team that has been here for the last 50 years. And so I think people in general are feeling good. It doesn't make, you know, hungry people any less hungry, and it doesn't make, you know, children that need, you know, shoes any less in need. But I think in terms of the city spirit, it's undoubtable, and it's palpable that there's been a lift, a change.
It's important to put all that in context, and thanks for doing it. There is negative feeling on the part of some Mexican Americans in particular because of the way that Dodger Stadium was built, the fact that so many people were moved out to make way for Dodger Stadium in Chavez Ravine.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I tell you, there's a reason for that, but it's also, I think, kind of a misnomer. You know, the Dodgers were not the ones that were packing up families and moving them out of their houses. It was being done by the city. It was being done, you know, the whole history of that episode goes back to the federal housing right. and the city housing getting together and trying to buy people out, and they did so family by family. The whole thing fell apart because it was the era of McCarthyism, and anything that smacked of any kind of social management was, you know, labeled the communist thing. It left the barrios, which had been there not just since the 40s, but even before in the 30s, living in the wake. And so Paul Polson and the boys that, you know, were rebuilding Bunker Hill got together and decided that would be a good place to attract the ballpark. So, you know, the city council, Polson, the powers that be got
Polson,
together.
Polson, the mayor at the time.
Norris Polson, who was the mayor at the time, got together, made it possible. You know, I mean, Roz Wyman was working on getting the team here, and they were working on getting the space. And so they moved the last of the families out of the traditional old barrio. You're talking about a community that's constantly being either overlooked or picked upon. You know, I know all about eminent domain. I grew up in East L.A. in the 60s when we got moved for the East L.A. interchange. And we got moved 5 years later when they expanded the 10 freeway. But you didn't see a whole bunch of helicopters in Channel 5 there because it was in East L.A. But because of the Dodgers and because of the cabal, it was all there and focused upon that. And it was indeed to make room for the Dodgers. But it wasn't the Dodgers that did it. It was the city people that said, we'll give you the space. But it did carry a lot of resentment for a long time with a lot of people. But, you know, Mexicans came here playing baseball. People think, you know, well, Mexicans and soccer. But, you know, at the turn of the century, soccer was a club sport. It was being played by the elite in Argentina and Uruguay and Paraguay. Baseball, la pelota, is what was being played in the streets. It was being played in Cuba since the 1870s. And baseball has been part of our culture. And I also think that it became part of what made us American. So you've got this dichotomy of a Mexican-American community in Los Angeles traditionally, which is we have the scar of Chavez Ravine. And I'm not trying to polish it over. I'm just trying to say it was not all that they say it was. But you've also got the fact that Latinos have been baseball fans and have been a core and loyal family for 50 years with the Dodgers.
Now, let's go back to that game you saw in 1963. Sandy Koufax struck out Mickey Mantle. How many other Yankees went down to him?
You know, Koufax was throwing people out every other game. I mean, he had 18 and 16 and 13 regularly. So I think he had about a dozen that day. I think it was Mantle who took him out of the park. He also gave up a home run. But it was not just the strikeouts. It was the sheer mastery. There were days when Koufax walked out on that mound and started throwing, and everybody in the place knew he was simply utterly unbeatable. You've seen that maybe three or four times in the history of the ballgame. Maybe Steve Carlton on certain days when he came in. Bob Gibson, you know, people like that were just utterly overwhelming. And Koufax was that kind of pitcher. And that's the kind of game he had that day.
You are really a historian. I'm going to interrupt you because I wanted you to talk just a little bit more about the stadium itself. In what way it reflects its own era when it was built in the 1960s?
Well, if you look at it, I mean, you know, it's built like a Neutra house. I mean, it's split level. It's got all the markings of a 1960 core architecture, and it's landscaped over a scaled environment that reflects the use of space in those days. Going back to the late 50s and early 60s, I mean, take a look at the way they were building houses on the hill overlooking the view of the city. Take a look at the way they were building houses out in the Malibu area. It's got that style to it. It's got that, you know, I mean, it's anachronistic now, but the way it was built is reflective of the times and what was being, you know, touted as prime architecture and use of space.
Okay, are the Dodgers now playing in that stadium, which a lot of people say has gotten too old, do you think going to come back again?
Oh, heck yeah. Of course they are. I mean, the stadium is not going to, you know, I think they should preserve the stadium and not take it down and put another one up. It really is a historic park. And are the Dodgers going to come back? They've got the league's Cy Young Award winner. They've got the guy that should have been the most valuable player. And they got a crop of young ball players that are coming up. They've got a change in ownership, and they've got a fiercely loyal fan base that will likely accept the higher prices of food and parking and tickets over the next few years to pay for the $2 billion switch. They're coming back.
And the fan base includes Tomas Benitez, development director at Plaza de la Raza, also advisor to Baseball Reliquary. That's a traveling museum. And you're a hell of a talker. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Great to have you. We'll be right back with Which Way LA.
You're listening to Which Way LA from KCRW. Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/whichwayla or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter at WWLA.
Warman Ali back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA, talking with Hal Gonzalez, our reporter, our plastic bag correspondent.
And the plastic bag user, too. Not only that, I use them probably each and every week because I always forget
to take
my...
Well, you're not supposed to. You just heard that.
But I always take my... I always forget my cloth bag. We're going to get into this later. My cloth bag to the market with me. I need an app. Someone has to invent an app for me to remind me and the millions of others like me to take the reusable bag with me to the market. But we're not here to talk about that.
You need an app to... deal with all of the different laws now being passed with regard to bags at stores.
You know, you're exactly right. And, you know, that the song we were just hearing to, it's a cover version of a Empire State of Mind, and this one about plastic bags. But it can also be, and being anti-plastic bag, but it also kind of captures the celebratory mood of the anti-plastic bag movement. They're in a very, very good place here in California. Particularly in the last year, there was a big Supreme Court ruling, state Supreme Court ruling last year that basically made it easier for municipalities and counties to pass anti-plastic bag laws. It was being challenged by the industry, by the plastic bag industry, the chemical industry. They wanted municipalities to conduct a full EIR, an environmental impact review. And the judge said no. The judges said no, that's not going to happen. And then late last month, you had another significant ruling here for Los Angeles County. There was a challenge to its plastic bag ban, which was rejected by a judge. The industry was arguing that it was, the 10-cent per bag charge, which is now the case in L.A. County.
For the paper bag. You have to pay
for the paper bag.
You can't have a plastic bag.
You can't have a plastic bag at all. You get a 10-cent per bag charge when you take the store's paper bags, that could stand. It was not a tax because the judge argued that none of the money is going to county coffers.
But where does the money go?
Well, that's just it. I mean, that's a conversation I still think we have to have here in L.A. County.
Stays with the store, but there's nobody to say what the store is supposed to do with it.
Exactly. It's supposed to stay within the store, within the company, and they're supposed to use it to improve their recycling programs, to improve, to conform with the plastic bag rules and regulations, to do public outreach. But nobody's really shined a light on that yet. So, but that's a conversation for another time. I would like to talk, if we could, about Santa Monica's plastic bag ban. I was on the streets today in two different stores. The first sound we're going to hear is from a shopper at Trader Joe's. Santa Monica is significant because it enacted its own plastic bag ban last year, and it's charging 10 cents for the paper bags. And this is the view of one shopper who I met up with in the parking lot. What's your name, ma'am?
Susan Haste.
We're here in Santa Monica where they charge 10 cents for the paper bag. Other cities are considering adopting it. Good idea?
I think people do need to be forced into forming better habits in order to be a better person.
They need a stick.
Yeah, they need a stick, exactly, and I think it's a good thing.
And 10 cents a bag is that stick?
Yeah, that's the stick, and it works for me. You know, like if I have to pay 10 cents a bag, I'll carry out my stuff and put them in the bags in my car, you know? It's a practice. It's all a process. And
behavioral readjustment.
Exactly, exactly.
They say you can buy a paper bag for 10 cents, but there is a lawsuit, I believe, now pending that says the paper bags are worse than the plastic bags.
That is a big line of argument among opponents of these laws, saying that paper bags are certainly no improvement over plastic bags. They could be worse. They cost more to manufacture.
They take down trees.
They take down 14 million trees a year that are being consumed to make make the paper bag. So, yeah, that is a very important argument. And I think you'll increasingly hear that we should ban all bags, and that's what the city of Los Angeles is proposing. Councilman Paul Koretz has introduced some legislation that would introduce a ban of first plastic bags, and then 6 months later, paper bags.
So that might even include you then, because so far the change in habits hasn't applied to you. You said you still use plastic bags.
I do, but you know what? I was at the Trader Joe's. You just heard that voice from the Trader Joe's parking lot. I started thinking about this seriously because I started shopping there, because I would leave KCRW and go home and to Eagle Rock, and I would stop there. And at first, I was like taken aback, like, "What? You want me you want me to buy the bag that I'm carrying the groceries out with?" And now I'm much more likely to have a couple of cloth bags in my car because I know I'm going to be stopping at that store. Now there are those though who are staunch proponents of plastic bags who say, you know, we do our own kind of recycling with the plastic bags that are available, and I think that's going to be the second voice you hear.
What's your name?
Norma.
Norma.
DeSophie.
So what are your views about plastic bags? Why are they important in your life?
They're not, how can I say, terribly important, but I need them on and off because I use the plastic bags after I take my groceries out, and I stick them in my garbage can to use, you know, when you want to throw garbage out, you use plastic. I don't have to buy a special plastic bags. I use these that I get from the grocery store.
So it's a kind of recycling for you.
It's a recycling for me. Then I let somebody else worry about it. You know what I mean? I don't want to worry about it.
But the garbage doesn't get recycled. It goes to the dump.
The plastic bag gets recycled maybe a time or two more. But I think Sophie speaks to, there's a constituency out there of people who say, we use these plastic bags for other purposes. I think there's a huge number of people who just use them just for the dog and cat poop, if I could say poop on the air, for that purpose. And they're very concerned of when those bags vanish in their communities, what do they do? And, of course, there are other options, but, you know. That's their first reaction is how am I going to use this? How am I going to pick up my dog poop, my cat poop? What am I going to use as a makeshift garbage bag if I don't have the plastic bags from the store?
88 cities in Los Angeles County and the county, and it's conceivable they're all going to have different laws about this.
Well, in Los Angeles County, outside of municipalities, has this one law which bans the plastic bags and has the charge for the 10-cent charge for paper bags. What's interesting now, you might want to start looking at the state level. This was introduced in 2010, a law that would ban plastic bags across the state. That did not go through the legislature. The assemblywoman behind that legislation is interested in reintroducing it. So this could be fought on the state level again in Sacramento sooner rather than later.
And the county ban, which was upheld by a lower court, is now going to be challenged in an appellate court.
Yes, it is. And again, there's a lot of money involved here in both paper and plastic bags. This is a huge industry in the Carolinas where a lot of bags are made, here in Southern California. And it's an industry that's not going to go, you know, lightly into the night. They're going to fight this tooth and claw like they have in municipalities and like they have on the state level.
And somebody's going to finally get a journalism prize when they figure out what the stores are doing with that 10 cents that you're supposed to give the store when you buy a paper bag in the county.
That and a consumer prize for the technology that's going to remind people to take their cloth bags to the market with them.
Saul Gonzalez, bag reporter for KCRW. Good to have you.
I'm so honored to have that title, Warren. Thank you so much.
You can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page in a moment. Academic freedom, is it a disguise for religion? On Which Way LA. Warren, only back with Which Way LA. The Tennessee legislature passed a bill protecting teachers from helping students, and here's the quote, review in an objective manner the scientific strengths and scientific weaknesses of existing scientific theories, including evolution, the chemical origins of life, global warming, and human cloning. Governor Bill Haslam let it go into law today. David Fowler is a former state senator whose Family Action Council helped to draft the measure. Good to have you back on our program.
Well, it's good to be back after a six-year hiatus. I look forward to seeing y'all in, 2018?
Well, maybe sooner than that. Who knows? Why do you need this law in Tennessee?
Well, actually, the genesis for the bill was I had a couple of parents that contacted me about 2 years ago who were pretty well-versed in this subject and were upset that the teaching seemed to be completely one-sided in terms of what was presented. And I said, well, I don't really know much about what our law is here or our curriculum framework. So went to the old code book and pulled out the curriculum frameworks. In Tennessee, what we do is we have a State Board of Education that is an appointed board, serves, I think, 8-year terms or something like that. And the legislature authorizes them to develop curriculum for the various grades, and then the state board develops these curriculum frameworks, which establish at every grade what you're supposed to know in the various subject areas. So I went and looked at the one on biodiversity and just all of the ones dealing with the sciences, and what we found was that there was no language like in several states that talked about developing critical thinking skills, helping students understand the strengths and weaknesses of various scientific theories and the evidence in support of them. And in fact, the curriculum framework says in terms of their testing that all they're required to know is the evidence that supports evolution. So I began looking at what some other states did, trying to find what other states do. Is this what other states do or don't? And that's what led us to bring a bill to make it clear that our teachers don't have to pretend the students ask questions if they would seem to be contrary to the support of evolution, that they would feel free to talk about the subject without fear of being disciplined. And as I got to looking around what happened in the country, although we've not had any known problems in Tennessee, many people who express reservations about some of the scientific theories wind up getting in trouble. They don't get tenure. They lose scholarship funds, particularly in the higher education. So we brought this bill, which the Department of Education and the State Board of Education both said was consistent with our existing curriculum framework, but simply makes it clear that teachers don't have to worry about discussing these issues in class.
What about global warming? You also included that. Is there scientific doubt that the temperatures, in fact, are going up?
Well, from what I understand, and I'm not, a scientist. I'm a lawyer. But, actually, I read the other week in the Wall Street Journal, there was an article published by a couple of scientists. It may have been a week or 2 weeks ago that indicates that that the global warming that had been predicted is not transpired at the rates. And in fact, the article said, over the last 10 years, there's really not been the warming, and that most of this is based off of computer-generated models. Now, again, we've got scientists on the program who can talk more about
okay.
that. But anyway, the point being simply that, teachers should feel free If a student asks a question, not feel like, well, we need to move on or I have to ignore it, but can answer the question. If they ask, well, I've heard that some people don't think carbon dioxide is cause of global warming or whatever it would be. So I hope that answers your question.
Okay. In the law, and I want our listeners to know this, in the law it says that this only protects the teaching of scientific information, shall not be construed to promote any religious or non-religious doctrine or promote discrimination for or against religion or non-religion. Why did you put that language in there? Your organization, the Family Action Council, is religiously oriented, isn't it?
Well, we certainly are, but we recognize what the limits are according to what our United States Supreme Court has said in interpreting our Constitution. And And so we wanted to acknowledge that. And we also wanted to try to cut off the argument that apparently we've not been able to cut off, that somehow this is going to allow teachers to start teaching creationism or intelligent design. And in fact, we not only put that language in, but if people read the bill, it refers to the existing curriculum frameworks required by the state board. We said that in multiple places. So that people could say, oh, if all you can teach is what's in the curriculum framework, there is nothing in the curriculum framework about intelligent design or creation or any of that. So we tried to head off all of these arguments, but I appreciate you've actually read the bill. So thank you.
Okay, David Fowler, again, former state senator, now with the Family Action Council in Tennessee. Larissa DeSantis is assistant professor of earth and environmental sciences at Vanderbilt University. She wrote an online petition against Tennessee's new legislation and collected 5,000 signatures. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much for having me.
What's wrong with this?
So the legislation is not needed. So he mentions that there's this problem that he's solving, but there really isn't. Currently, you can have all of the scientific debates that you want to have in the classroom. You can discuss, you know, why dinosaurs went extinct. Was it a meteor? Was it climate change? Was it a combination? You can have all of these scientific debates in the classroom today, and so the legislation is not necessary.
Why, then, are you worried about it?
Because it's trying to introduce what they call the weaknesses of evolution and the weaknesses of climate change. And in fact, there are none. If a teacher came to me and asked, what are the weaknesses? I could not provide them with any weaknesses. These are core fundamental ideas. And what's particularly scary as both an educator, scientist, but also as a parent, is that I worry that this is going to take up valuable time in the classroom. So my husband is a high school teacher in public schools, and he is hard-pressed to cover all of the science standards that are required. By allowing teachers to now teach the weaknesses of evolution and the weaknesses of climate change, things that don't exist, is going to sort of dumb down the science education in the state. And I fear that for the students in the state and also for my daughter.
You say it'll dumb down if they teach those things, but as I understand former Senator Fowler, nobody has to teach anything. This is just protects them if they want to.
Sure. But the problem is that while some fantastic teachers and many teachers are on board will continue to teach the science as the science is represented in the scientific literature, there are others who may not completely understand it. Often the media portrays these things as a 50-50 split, but they are not. The vast, vast majority of scientists accept evolution and accept climate change as core fundamental ideas. We argue about the details. What are the rates of climate change? What are the effects of climate change on various organisms? What are the details as to how these different organisms are related? But we never argue about whether evolution is occurring, and we never argue about whether humans are the culprit or causing our climate change to occur.
So, David Fowler, back to you then. Here's a scientist who says that the consensus of her profession is that this law is simply not needed and that it might clutter up the curriculum. And others have said that it might make Tennessee look ridiculous.
Well, I'm kind of reminded of Rudyard Kipling said, you're a man if you can keep your head while all about you are losing yours. And so it really doesn't matter what everybody else has to say. What matters is what Tennessee has to say about what it wants to teach and what it wants to do. Secondly, I think it's very interesting that we're supposed to teach the consensus. I'm sure there will be a challenge to go much beyond what the consensus is. But if all we're going to do is teach science as rote memorization, then we're not really developing science.
So, Larissa DeSantis, back to you then. What about the idea that this is part of learning critical thinking?
If that's really the case, then we don't need this piece of legislation. We can analyze scientific evidence. We can have debates. We can engage in critical thinking today. And we can do that across all disciplines. We can do it in science. We can do it in history, in English, in all of these disciplines. This piece of legislation singles out science and, in particular, things like global warming and evolution.
One of the reasons this has attracted so much attention is the history of Tennessee. In 1925, 2005, a Tennessee jury convicted John Scopes for teaching evolution. He was later let off on a technicality. In the film, and subsequent to that, evolution became, as we've heard, a part of the regular curriculum. In the film Inherit the Wind, Spencer Tracy played Scopes' attorney, who was Clarence Darrow.
Can't you understand that if you take a law like evolution and you make it a crime to teach it in the public schools, tomorrow you can make it a crime to teach it in the private schools, and tomorrow you may make it a crime to read about it, and soon you may ban books and newspapers, and then you may turn Catholic against Protestant, and Protestant against Protestant, and try to foist your own religion upon the mind of man. If you can do one, you can do the other, because fanaticism and ignorance is forever busy. And needs feeding.
Very impassioned performance by Spencer Tracy. David Fowler, back to you again. By causing this discussion to reemerge, are you putting Tennessee in a position, even though you don't care what other people think outside the state, where they might be subject to the kind of criticism we just heard being read by Spencer Tracy?
Well, if people are going to base their opinions about Tennessee on fiction, which Inherit the Wind is, and actually, when you read the transcripts, it's clearly that the author of Inherit the Wind had an agenda, and it's a fictionalized story, although based on true events. And so, you know, if we want to base our opinions on things based on fact or fiction, then those that use fiction, there's nothing much I can do about it. But what's interesting is I almost hear coming from the scientific community the very complaints that were being leveled in that speech, that if we can prohibit or discourage states from passing laws that simply say students should develop critical thinking skills and look carefully at the strengths and weaknesses of various scientific theory, then I would suggest that today we have the roles reversed, and that the people in the scientific community are the ones who don't want anybody asking any questions, anybody thinking about the subject. And I completely disagree, and you will, I think, later have on Casey Luskin with the Discovery Institute. There are many scientists who do not believe that neo-Darwinism explains all the complexity that we observe in the physical world.
Okay, let me give Larissa DeSantis an opportunity to respond to that. Are you, in fact, have you switched sides in this debate?
No, and actually my question for David Fowler is, why does this piece of legislation focus on science, and in particular evolution and climate change? Because if it truly is an academic freedom piece of legislation, then it would not focus on those particular areas. Additionally, this is a long-standing sort of movement often provided by folks at the Discovery Institute to try to teach the controversy. And I'll let others speak to that instead. But this piece of legislation is not needed. It really brings the political controversy of these topics into the classroom where scientific controversy does not exist.
Okay. I think David Fowler needs to leave us. Senator, thank you very much for being
our
program.
Thank you.
I do want to introduce Edward Larson. He's a law professor at Pepperdine University, Pulitzer Prize winner, as author of Summer for the Gods, The Scopes Trial and America's Continuing Debate Over Science and Religion. Professor Larson, we only have a moment before we go to a break, but let me ask you for a sort of topic sentence here. Does all this sound familiar?
Well, of course, it's the same story again, but it's a story that that emanates from the deep felt beliefs of the people of Tennessee.
And what about the idea that scientists and people concerned about the Bible have switched places?
I mean, I don't see that as the case. I mean, there's just not a parallel between those two issues. The people of Tennessee don't believe in evolution. The majority of polls will show that they don't believe in that humans developed from a lower form of animal life, and they don't want their students taught that as scientific truth that disagrees with their profound understanding of how the world operates.
So you see this then, regardless of the way that the law is written, and it's very carefully written, as I indicated, to remove religious considerations, you think that's what is at the base of it?
I think it's not whether or not there are religious considerations. The issue is that the people of Tennessee and many people in the United States do not believe in the theory of evolution. The new Tennessee law is modeled after a law that was passed in Louisiana 3 years ago, 2008, which says much the same thing. And there they call on teachers that if teachers want to teach scientific ideas critical of, in that case, of evolution or global warming, they include both. They also include human cloning, so as to, as they put it in the Louisiana law, help students to understand, analyze, critique, and review these scientific theories. They are encouraged to do so, and the state will back them. That is the same thrust when the senator talked about modeling it after other states' laws. He was speaking of the Louisiana law. This is a movement teaching the controversy, as they call it, coming out of the intelligent design movement to try to increase people's debate over the so-called controversy and over the theory of evolution and of related theories, and global warming being one of them.
Edward Larson, once again, Pulitzer Prize winner for Summer for the Gods, the Scopes Trial, and America's Continuing Debate over Science and Religion. Josh Rossinow is a Programs and Policy Director at the National Center for Science Education. That's a not-for-profit membership organization defending the teaching of evolution and climate science as well in public schools. Josh Rossinow, good to have you on our program.
Great to be here.
And I assume that when you say defending the teaching of evolution and climate science, you mean not teaching the controversy about them.
Well, yeah, there's not a scientific controversy to be taught is the issue. There's a political controversy, certainly a religious controversy, as some of your previous guests have pointed out. But there's not in the scientific community today a controversy about whether evolution happens. As Larissa said, there is a lot of research that goes on about how that happens, how that plays out, what's the role of natural selection versus genetic drift, say. But whether it happens at all is just not a controversy, and bills like this that open the door to creationism or climate change denial or these other sorts of pseudoscience or non-science in science classrooms just do a disservice to students.
What about global warming? Earlier we heard our first guest, David Fowler, former state senator in Tennessee, the man who helped provide the language for this law, say that he'd read in the Wall Street Journal that things are not as they are claimed by scientists with regard to global warming.
Well, there are a lot of great things to be said about the Wall Street Journal, but it's not a reputable science journal. And one of the sources that they cite in that op-ed, William Nordhaus, who they claim as one of the people who supports their ideas, wrote an extended reply to them in the New York Review of Books later on, pointing out that they misrepresented his words, misrepresented his ideas, and misrepresented the science really badly. I think it would be much more appropriate to look at a letter that was published in, I believe, Nature a couple years back that was signed by over 200 scientists, or to look at things like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, where the climate science community as a whole gets together periodically to say, here is the current state of the science.
Josh Rossinow again at the National Center for Science Education. As advertised by our earlier guest, David Fowler, our next guest is Casey Luskin. He's a research coordinator at the Discovery Institute. That's a nonprofit think tank in Seattle dealing with public policy and technological issues, best known for its involvement in the evolution debate. Casey Luskin, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me on.
What do you say to what we heard earlier, that you're part of a movement which is designed to try to teach the controversy about evolution in particular, global warming as well, when in fact there is no such thing as a scientific controversy about these things?
Well, these are simply bluffs from people who want to censor scientific dissent from the consensus. Over 800 PhD scientists have signed a list stating that they are, in fact, skeptical of neo-Darwinian evolution, which is what it is taught in most textbooks. There's also a nationwide pattern of teachers feeling intimidated into silence when covering controversial scientific topics. So this claim that Dr. DeSantis made that there's no need for a bill like this is simply not true. Professor Larson mentioned Louisiana. In Louisiana, there was a survey conducted of teachers before they passed their bill, which found that over 50% of teachers felt intimidated into not being able to talk freely about objective scientific controversies in the classroom. And I think that this is a nationwide pattern that teachers don't know what their rights are, and they don't know if they're really able to talk about controversial scientific topics. So a bill like this is needed to tell teachers, yes, you do have the rights to objectively present scientific information for or against these controversial scientific topics without having to worry about losing your jobs. This bill is about protecting teachers and allowing them to teach good science and objective science in the classroom.
50% of the teachers in Louisiana said they felt intimidated about exactly what, and were any of them disciplined?
Well, this is one of those problems that leaks, that kind of lurks beneath the surface. If a teacher is feeling intimidated into silence over teaching these controversial subjects, then they're not going to be able to talk about the controversy, and they're not going to be disciplined. However, there have been a number of incidents nationwide where teachers have been disciplined. They lost their jobs. They've been transferred to teaching PE because of the simple fact that they were trying to challenge and teach students about scientific challenges to Darwinian evolution and other controversial theories. There is a climate of fear and intimidation that permeates the science classroom, and many teachers don't feel free to talk objectively about this. You know, Dr. DeSantis said that somehow this bill would dumb down science education. The whole field of science education theorists disagrees with her. The field of science education theory today says that the best way to teach science is to teach students evidence for or and against various concepts, let them weigh the evidence, wrestle with it, use these as critical thinking exercises, and learn to look at both sides of an issue. This is how students best learn science. So the effect of this bill would only improve science education. It would not somehow dumb down science education or diminish the quality of the education that students are getting.
Casey Luskin at the Discovery Institute. Let me put that one to Josh Rosenau with the Center for Science Education. How do you respond to this argument that, in fact, there really is a dispute and that the only way to teach critical thinking is to let kids see both sides and weigh them and make the decisions on their own?
You know, I don't think that bills like this are needed for any of those goals. The idea that, Mr. Fowler before claimed that the state standards don't have anything about critical thinking, but they do. It's already covered there. It's right at the top of the page on when you look at the state standards on their website is issues about critical thinking. There are ways to talk about critical thinking without going outside of science in science classrooms. And as Larissa said very well, there's no reason to restrict that only to science classrooms, as this bill does. What Casey was mentioning before of teachers who he claims have been disciplined, I suspect he's thinking of a case in Minnesota where a teacher was presenting creationist lessons and an administrator said, no, you're not allowed to do that, and moved him to a different classroom when he refused to obey the district curriculum. And in that case, courts said that, you know, the teacher went to court and said that he had an academic freedom right to present whatever he pleased in classrooms. And the court said no, that the teacher has to obey what principals and administrators say. And this law takes that power away, takes the power away from locally elected school boards, from principals and from other administrators in the district. It prohibits them from stepping in and saying, no, you've crossed a line here. And that's really worrisome because that's how these conflicts should be resolved. It should be, you know, a parent should be able to go to a principal and say, I'm concerned that my child is bringing home information that I know to be factually incorrect. If the only way to present to teach critical thinking is to bring in factually incorrect claims, I think we have a real problem, and I don't think that that's necessary.
So you're saying that creationism, which is a religious idea, is in fact the only other side of the theory of what's referred to as neo-Darwinism, and it's not scientific?
Yeah, there is no scientifically credible alternative to evolution. That's not to say that in 20 years something might be different, but if there is something different, it won't start out in public school classrooms. It'll start out in research labs, and it'll be taught in graduate seminars. And then it'll be taught in undergraduate seminars, and then in introductory classes in college. And then, if it's pedagogically appropriate, it'll show up in high schools. But to try to jump in line like this and say, oh, you know, someday there might be some alternative, so let's just put it into high schools, whatever that might be, without any vetting and without an opportunity for the experts in science pedagogy in a school district and the locally elected school board to be able to say, you know, that's not appropriate, it can only lead to disaster.
Casey Luskin, back to you. The Discovery Institute, again, involved with evolution for a long period of time. Is it creationism that you really want to see taught? Is that what's behind all this?
No, and these are talking points that are really tired talking points that we hear from people who basically want to censor scientific critique of evolution in the schools. As you mentioned earlier, Mr. Olney, the bill itself has language which expressly prohibits the teaching of religion. It would be impossible for the teaching of creationism to be protected under this bill.
So what then is the scientific objection to evolution?
But the whole idea that there is no scientific controversy here is just a simple bluff. I mean, look at what Lynn Margulis, who's a member of the National Academy of Sciences that died last year, she wrote that mutations tend to induce sickness, death, or deficiencies. No evidence in the vast literature of heredity changes shows unambiguous evidence the random mutation itself, even with geographical isolation of populations, leads to speciation. There are many peer-reviewed scientific papers that are challenging the core tenets of Darwinian evolution as they are taught in textbooks. We're not talking about esoteric debates that only scientists in graduate seminars are debating. We're talking about the evidence that students are being taught in textbooks. Core fundamental tenets of neo-Darwinism, like the idea that natural selection is sufficient to produce the complexity of life, or that there is a grand tree of life that shows how all living organisms are related. These core tenets of Darwinism are coming under attack in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. And if scientists can talk about challenges to the evidence that is simply presented in a dumbed-down fashion in many textbooks, why can't students learn about those challenges as well? Why can't students learn that scientists are beginning to doubt the very core tenets of neo-Darwinian theory, which are being presented as fact in their textbook? We're talking about teaching good science and good education, and I can't see why any reasonable person would want to oppose this bill.
Josh Rosen, now your response.
You know, the language in the bill, most bills don't have a disclaimer in them saying this bill is not about religion. It's sort of like if we're having friends over for dinner and my wife says, well, why don't we have this one friend over? And I say, well, I've got nothing against that friend, but maybe we should have someone else. It kind of means that I do have something against that friend. When this bill says, oh, this is not about religion.
Well, what about these peer-reviewed challenges to Darwinism and the idea by Lynn Margulis that mutations, in fact, don't lead to the kind of changes that evolution says they do? What about those papers? Are they worthless? Are they non-existent? How do you respond to what we heard from Casey Luskin?
I think Casey is overstating his case a little bit. Lynn Margulis is no longer alive to defend herself on this point, but she was a frequent she had put out statements through her life when people were misrepresenting her views like this, and made it clear that she is fully supportive of the idea of the basic framework of evolution. She did a lot of the reason that she was a member of the National Academies was that she did a lot of innovative research pushing the boundaries of what we understood about evolutionary mechanisms. But she was not questioning the existence of a tree of life. She was not questioning she had other mechanisms in mind, and some of them she was right about and some of them she was decidedly wrong about. But those are the sorts of debates that are certainly appropriate for the peer-reviewed literature that specialists can dispute. But in a high school classroom, you're laying a foundation. You have to learn to walk before you learn to run. And to say, well, we should just, dump students, give students a bunch of journals before they've learned the basics of biology, it just strikes me as profoundly misunderstanding how science education works and how science works.
Larissa DeSantis, back to you, Assistant Professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Vanderbilt University. What about this language that Casey Luskin has referred to, which I read earlier from the Tennessee statute that says they're not trying to promote religion at all? Why isn't that sufficient to persuade you that this is not a dangerous piece of legislation?
Because by not teaching evolution in the classroom, that is dangerous. Evolution and climate change are core fundamental ideas, and we are basically moving into an increasingly complex world where we're going to have to make more decisions that require scientific literacy. We need students to understand what evolution is. Antibiotic resistance relies on an understanding of evolution. Understanding how we can respond to climate change that is occurring, that requires a fundamental understanding of climate change. And so if we are not teaching these things, that's a fundamental problem.
It doesn't say, though, the law doesn't say not to teach them. It says that it's okay to teach that there's controversy about them.
Right, but the problem is there isn't controversy. In the scientific literature, if you look at those with PhDs in in scientific fields, and if you look at Nature, Science, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, PLOS One, all of these top scientific journals, you will not see evidence of a debate over whether these fundamental core ideas are occurring. You will only see, you know, a discussion of how they are happening, a discussion of evolution. And so by allowing things like quote-unquote weaknesses of evolution or weaknesses of climate change to enter in the classroom, you're basically not teaching, you're not teaching science. You're teaching, you're introducing and bringing sort of a political message into the classroom. There is no science that supports, or that there are no scientific weaknesses of evolution or climate change. They just don't exist.
Okay, Casey Luskin, 1 minute left to explain your case again. Go ahead.
Well, your listeners are getting a great taste of the dogmatism that sadly is pervasive throughout the scientific community today. Imagine now how this climate infects the education world, where teachers are being forced and told dogmatically there are no weaknesses in evolution. There is no controversy. If you say there are problems with evolution, then you are teaching non-science or pseudoscience or creationism. These kinds of statements that you heard on this show today justify exactly why this bill is needed.
Okay, back to Edward Larson again at Pepperdine University, the Pulitzer Prize winner for his book about the Scopes trial. Once again, is this the same dispute that we heard in 1925?
It's a variation of it, in the sense that the source behind it is a popular concern about what science is teaching, the basic scientific doctrine. Certainly, Casey's right. There's different ideas of how evolution operates, and Lynn Margulis, who is a good friend of mine, thought there was gene flows in a, that was fundamental, and those ideas are taught, should be taught. They should be included. But the core, what makes this a popular, as opposed to an esoteric debate, a popular debate that gets a state like Tennessee or Louisiana to pass a law on this subject, is because there's a popular opposition to the theory of evolution. There's also popular opposition to the ideas of global warming. That can activate groups to get involved, to try to pass legislation, to try to restrict or limit its presentation. That's what happened in 1925. Okay. I agree, Inherit the Wind was a fictional presentation of it, and developed the idea differently, but it was a popular movement then led by a populist, William Jennings Bryan, and it's a popular movement now based in profound religious and social views of the proponents.
Edward Larson at Pepperdine University, where he teaches law, author of Summer for the Gods, The Scopes Trial, and America's Continuing Debate Over Science and Religion. Thanks to you. Thanks to Casey Luskin with the Discovery Institute, Josh Rosenau with the National Center for Science Education, Larissa DeSantis at Vanderbilt University, and our earlier guest, former State Senator David Farler of Tennessee, and the Family Action Council. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point, Which Way LA was produced tonight by Sonia Geis, Katie Cooper, and Caitlin Schamberg. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can visit the Which Way LA blog for more stories about Los Angeles at kcrw.com/whichwayla blog. I'm Armin Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation and the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation.